Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
We don't move on. I mean, we are working on this dream 5 years now. I'm thinking about this since more than 12 years now. And we believe that we are at the verge of finding a way to do that. And still, there are so many people telling you it's just impossible. So never believe people telling you it's impossible. Never. This might be another characteristic, but not a characteristic of a social entrepreneur, but of maybe of an entrepreneur. Whatever we do, we cannot do it or succeed alone. Never. We need partners. We need to network with others. We need partners. We need to learn from partners, and we need to build together new solutions. This is absolutely important. We have to fight prejudices and preconceived convictions from many policymakers, many donors, many stakeholders in our businesses.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Yves Marie. Yves is the founder, president, and chief executive officer of Fondation Capital, an international non-profit social enterprise. Fondation Capital is a pioneer in inclusive finance innovation, helping the poor save, grow, and invest their assets, insure their families against risk, and chart a permanent path out of poverty. Today, Fondation Capital reaches 3 million people, and it aims to reach 8 million people more in the next few years by expanding access to training, capital, and opportunity. Yves is an economist and management engineer from the University of Louvain in Belgium, and has more than 25 years' experience in international development and poverty reduction. He is a 2014 recipient of the Skoll Award for social entrepreneurship. I'd like to thank you, Yves, for talking to us today to Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs. I'd like to just maybe ask you to tell us a little bit about your background and your social entrepreneurial journey.
Oh, well, thank you, Fergal, for your interest in what we are doing. It's a complicated issue and not necessarily the most attractive for a journalist, so thank you for that. Well, it's always difficult to speak about myself, you know. I'm a founder and a chief executive officer of Fondation Capital. It's an international non-profit social enterprise, and we hope it to be a change maker, aiming at massive asset building for the poor worldwide. I'm an economist myself, a financier. I used to be a banker before, but the good one. I mean, not the ones we are observing or we've been observing in 2008.
Yes.
But I used to manage a small business bank in Peru before. Aiming at low and very low income populations. So at some point in time, I decided that it wasn't enough to serve hundreds of thousands of customers, but I wanted to change the life of millions. And this couldn't be done starting with my own small business bank. So I decided to create Fondation Capital and go to scale. When we speak about going to scale, you will surely agree with me that there are only two ways to go to scale. That is reaching millions instead of reaching dozens of thousands. The first way to do that is using market mechanisms in favor of low-income families and the poor. And the other way to do that is accompanying national governments in improving their inclusive public policies. Public policies are massive by definition. So this is the reason why I decided to create Fondation Capital and start working. That was 6 years ago, approximately. Before that, I spent 25 years in Latin America working on financial inclusion issues, micro and small enterprises development. And before that, I spent almost 10 years in Africa as doing more or less the same kind of thing. But as you can imagine, that was a long time ago. So this is what, I don't know if this is what I am, but this is what I was willing to do, and that's what we are now doing. And I'm quite happy to see that after five or six years of hard work, our work is recognized now by this Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship that I just received 2 weeks ago.
Yes. Yes. Congratulations. That must have been a great moment. Yeah, because it's you've been working for as you say 5 or 6 years, and inevitably they're the hardest years, the early years, trying to build up a project and get it off the ground and so forth. What was it like at the beginning? Did you face some challenges getting off the ground?
Well, of course. But first, let me make a precision. I'm not a social entrepreneur since 5 or 6 years. I've always been, or I always considered myself as a social entrepreneur.
That yes, is, yeah.
I was always willing to work for public goods or common goods.
Yes.
Know? So this might be a difference between a pure businessman or entrepreneur and what I've always been doing. Even when I was a banker, at the same time, I had a private consultancy working on financial inclusion issues, and those businesses, of course, were for profit. But the main goal was to create public goods, always. I think this is a story of my life. I've been doing that all my life. But Fondation Capital, yes, started 6 years ago. So. Oh, in fact, 5 years ago. Well, 6 years ago, but formally 5 years ago. Something like that. Formally, I mean, it's been incorporated 5 years ago, precisely.
Yeah.
To come back to your question, the first year is always complicated because I had several crazy ideas I wanted to implement, and nobody was believing those ideas would work. So at the beginning, I was alone. I mean, just me. And then 2 months ago, I recruited a first colleague. He's now our vice president for Latin America. And then a third one, fourth one, fifth one, and so on. So at the beginning, it's been a bit complicated. But now we are a group of 35 economists, activists, extremely focused and dedicated. So. But I cannot say it's been difficult on for monetary reasons. It's been difficult to convince people that our ideas were feasible. That's been the most complicated at the beginning because it's still in a way it still is, because we have to fight prejudices and preconceived convictions from many policymakers, many donors, many stakeholders in our businesses. But by chance, we started working with Ford Foundation. Ford Foundation was our first financier, first funder, and believed in our crazy ideas. So I have to say that and recognize their seminal work with us.
Yes.
And they accepted to take risk with us.
Right. Right. Obviously, you start off with this sense of financial exclusion. You mentioned you experienced right at the beginning of your career in different ways. How do you characterize the scale of this problem, and how important is it in terms of poverty generally?
Well, that's the first part of your question is very easy to answer. And the second one is requires probably a couple of hours to explain. But just for you to get an idea of the size of the problem, worldwide you have 2.5 billion adults unbanked. 2.5 billion adults unbanked. That's unbelievable. That's incredible. And you get an idea of the size of the problem. And I say problem because it is a real problem for the poor in particular, and low-income families, even middle-income families without access to financial services. It's a huge problem, and it's a problem because, how can I say that? I don't need to ask you, Fergal, if you have a bank account. You have, or maybe several. I don't need to ask you if you're insured. You are insured. I don't need to ask you if you've got several deposit-taking services options available. I don't need to ask you if you've got a magic plastic, different payment systems and cards. I don't need to ask you how you receive your honorarium or salaries, of course, in a bank account, etc., etc., and how you pay your electricity bill. If those services are more than useful, necessary, essential for us, they are essential for the poor also. It seemed to be an obvious argument, but it's not for everybody apparently. So when I was saying at the beginning, what those services that we take for granted, financial services in particular, are equally necessary for the poor. And many people didn't believe that. Many people would tell you, okay, you want the poor to be able to get access to savings accounts. But how come is it possible for them to save if they don't even have money to feed themselves? This is a prejudice. I've personally never seen a poor who wouldn't be saving. If she wouldn't be saving, she would be dead. Even destitute people are saving. A destitute meeting a loaf of bread in the street, one day would typically eat half of the bread today and keep the other half for tomorrow. And for any financier or economist, this is called savings. So poor people do save. They need to save. If they wouldn't be saving, they would be in deep problems or maybe dead. It's a risk management issue, but they are not necessarily, of course, they are usually not saving with the financial instruments that we are using. They save in traditional ways, a lot of traditional ways, different and the same, finally, all over the world. But they do save, having small animals in front of the house, exchanging money with the neighbors, pre-buying in bulk some food, or etc., etc., when they got resources. Poor people, or just under the mattress, but poor people do say, yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And what is your approach, and how is it distinctive from other organizations?
Well, you know, I've been part of this, how can I say that, micro credit crowds. That was a long time ago. Of course, I don't need to explain you what's microcredit. Everybody knows about microcredit, in particular since Mohamed Yunus famously said, that was maybe 15 years ago, that microcredit is a human right. During more than 30, maybe 40 years, governments and donors have been heavily investing in the development of the microcredit industry, believing that credit would be a kind of magic bullet for helping the poor get out of poverty, developing their own businesses and empowering themselves.
Yeah.
What we've been observing is that first, nobody feels empowered when being indebted. If you ever had a credit for buying a house or whatever, you feel empowered when you pay the last, you do the last payment to the bank.
Yes, yes.
Empowerment being indebted is not the appropriate term. But it's been used like that and sold like that. Women in particular, poor women are empowered because they got access to microcredit. I don't believe that, first. Second, credit by definition, and here you will excuse me, but I'll speak like a banker, but credit is for few people. Credit is not for everybody. Credit is exclusive by definition. to get access to credit, you need a bankable project, you need a conducive environment, you need character, at least the adequate character from a banking point of view, etc., etc. Credit is for few people, but savings is for everybody. And this is all about financial intermediation is. I mean, the core business of a bank is precisely that, mobilizing deposits from many to give credit to few. This is precisely what banking is all about. And it should be done like this. It's exactly the way it should be done. Now, if credit was an appropriate tool for reducing poverty, well, a country like Bangladesh, for instance, or Bolivia in Latin America, to take two examples of successful countries, successful micro credit industry in those countries, those two countries would be rich. As far as I remember, Bangladesh is still a poor country and Bolivia is still a poor country. So I'm not saying credit is useless. Of course, that'd be stupid. I'm saying credit is not a magic bullet to get out of poverty, and credit is not for everybody. Savings, yes, that's different, because savings help you if you're poor or extremely poor. Monetary savings help you better manage your scarce resources. Having a savings account or simple bank account help you manage your resources, protect your financial assets. That's extremely different. And so to answer your question again, during 40 years, all the microfinance, now microfinance industry, has been trying to include the excluded through credit, and this does not work. So I'm not the first one in thinking like that. I mean, you've got extraordinary people from the academic world that who are saying that since more than 20 years, or maybe 25 years. But we believe that savings is the way to go if you want a real financial inclusion process to be initiated.
Yeah,
that's completely different. It's a kind of Copernican revolution. I don't know if you say that in English.
Yes,
revolution.
Yes.
But anyway,
yes, a paradigm shift. But yes, a Copernican. Yes.
I don't like that word paradigm shift because everybody's using it. You know.
Yes, Copernicus is
change
the world upside down. Yeah, or perception of the world. I mean, I guess there are different aspects to this. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the poor people do save in different ways. So I suppose there's at least one important part of what you do is about education and getting the message across, I suppose, one as to the value of savings, and also, I suppose, in a way, the institutionalization of the savings, you know, of putting your money in some kind of form besides, you know, under your pillow.
Let me first take an example, if you allow me. When I say poor people do save, for instance, let's imagine a poor woman with one or two pigs in front of her house. These pigs are savings. Let's imagine her kids get sick and needs medicine. Let's imagine the pig is worth $100. I haven't got a clue about the price of a pig, but anyway. Let's imagine that woman needs $25 for buying medicines. She cannot, of course, take apart one leg of the pig. She needs to sell it immediately, in a hurry, probably not for $100, but maybe for $80 or $75, because she's in a hurry. She would typically sell it to a neighbor, and the neighbor typically would tell her, okay, I'll give you today the $25 you need, and $50 more in 6 months. Bad business. I mean, if that lady would have some money in a bank account, she would just withdraw $25 and that's it. You know, it seems little, but it's huge. It's a huge help for extremely poor people and poor people. A huge help. So it's not only about monetary savings, and it's not only about getting progressively access to other kind of financial services, starting from a savings account, but it's ultimately it's about asset building. How can I explain that? Since World War II, or since 45, or since 1950, most governments, when trying to design policies to help poor people, were believing that the poor are poor because they lack money. If they lack money, we need to find a way for them to have more money. And finding a way for them to have more money means developing policies based on income. So we need to find ways for them to get more income. And this is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, of course, poor people do need more income. This is obvious. But this is just a small part of the problem. As Amartya Sen has been famously saying, poverty is a trap of low assets and capabilities. Assets it's very, very different from income. Just to take an analogy, income is like a flow of water, a river passing, and assets is like a pound. If you cannot accumulate assets, you will never get out of poverty. And when I speak about assets, I don't only speak about financial assets. I also speak about physical assets, productive assets, human assets, education, health, social assets, network, communications, capabilities, etc., and natural resources also. Those five kind of assets are fundamental for the poor to find their way, their singular way out of poverty. And if we insist in financial asset building, it's for a very simple reason. It's that financial assets are easily re-transformable in other kind of assets. Health, education, housing, productive assets, etc., etc. That's the reason why. It's not only about accumulating financial assets. Of course, it's a key aspect, but not only that one. It's also about better managing your resources, not necessarily accumulating more and more and more resources, financial resources, but better managing your resources, smoothing your consumption level, you know, in time. When you have $1 available, you can put that dollar in your account, and when you need that dollar, you can withdraw it from your account. And this is a key aspect of having a simple bank account. I mean, it's as important as accumulating financial assets. Both things are important. So smoothing your consumption level and accumulating financial assets are two important issues when it comes to banking the unbanked, finally.
Over this 5 years, where are you today? Where is the main focus of your activities?
Okay, so one of the first idea that I wanted to develop 6 years ago was, at the beginning, was the following. In Latin America, as you know, we started working in Latin America first. We already work in 15 countries in Latin America. So in Latin America alone, you've got 17 countries with national conditional cash transfer programs. I don't know if you heard about that, or you know about what are conditional cash transfer programs. But cash transfer programs are public subsidies transferred usually monthly or bi-monthly to the poorest part of the population against a kind of core responsibility, that is, you need to have your kids in school and you need to have your kids health posts every 6 months or something like that. So if you do that, you receive every month a small subsidy from the government. The most important conditional cash transfer, CCT, as we say, program is in Latin America, worldwide, in fact, is in Brazil. It's called Bolsa Familia. It's quite well known. Or Oportunidades in Mexico. The first one reaches 16 million families. The second one, 13 million families. Altogether, those programs in Latin America alone reach approximately 25 million families. That's about 110 million people, direct beneficiaries of those programs. So those programs exist and they do transfer cash subsidies on a monthly basis, usually, to poor people. So the initial idea was to articulate our financial inclusion mechanisms that we've been developing for years, that I've been developing for 20 years, with those massive cash transfer programs. But that was easier to think than to do because, of course, on paper, this is a fantastic solution because you can reach quickly 25 million beneficiaries. Those beneficiaries were unbanked when we started working. That is, that they were receiving their subsidy cash in hand, in cash. And now we are convincing government to help them open a bank account and receive their subsidies in a bank account. With financial education, we can help those families get accustomed to the use of a bank account, progressively get access to other financial services, and progressively initiate this long road to full financial inclusion. So that was the first idea, linking financial inclusion and savings mobilization of the poor to massive programs like conditional cash transfer programs. And it's all about changing or improving or adjusting public policies, of course. So that was the first idea. So now we already banked more than 3.2 million families in Latin America. We believe in 2016 we will have banked 8 million families. And we believe that with appropriate stakeholders and partners working in Africa and Asia, we will bank 30 million families at least in the coming, before 2020, in the coming 8 years, 7 years, 6 years, something like that. So this is massive by definition, and if you compare with the results of the microcredit industry, it's far, far better, of course. Yeah. We speak about millions. I mean, we Fondation Capital is not interested in helping 10 or 20 or 50,000 people. This is fantastic for those people, but this is not going to change the poverty situation in any country. I mean, we need to reach millions. And if we want to make a dent into poverty, we need to speak about big numbers and really big numbers, millions or dozens of millions. If not, it's useless. I mean, if you help 10,000 families and get out of poverty, and at the same time you've got 20,000 families, newly born poor people, so it doesn't change anything.
Yeah, I mean, that is a massive scale. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, how do you go about having impact on millions?
What we do basically is we go and talk with top level policymakers, usually presidents or vice presidents or finance ministers or social development ministers. It depends on countries, but top level policymakers and try to convince them that linking banking solutions, financial inclusion solutions with those cash transfer programs is a good solution for everybody. It's of course a win for it's win-win-win-win. In fact, because it's a win for poor families, of course, women usually receiving those subsidies, because they can better protect and manage those subsidies. Imagine when those women were receiving their subsidy in cash. Just getting out of the bank or the payment organization with the cash in hand, let's say $30, $40, $50, you would have the husband immediately trying to get part of it or all of it. You would get the kid asking for Coca-Cola. You would get the mother-in-law saying, don't be bad, give me some of that money because I need it. And all of a sudden, your subsidy would disappear immediately or almost immediately. If you receive that money by a bank transfer in your account, nobody knows about it. Nobody knows how much money you have in your account. Anonymity is a key factor, indeed. And your money is better protected. So it's a win for the family themselves. It's a win for the cash transfer programs, because paying by bank transfers to an account opened in the name of the beneficiary is much, much cheaper and much more transparent than any other solutions previously used. So it's a win for those programs. They drastically reduce their operative costs. It's a win for the banking system, because all of a sudden you've got hundreds of millions of dollars getting out of the mattresses into the formal financial system. So for the banking system, it's a win. And we prove it with developing business cases for bankers. And of course, it's a win for the government as a whole, because the state, in fact, as a whole, because we help. I believe we really help in formalizing the informal economy. And as you know, in Latin America, in Africa, it's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Win-win-win-win situation. Everybody's winning. This is what we are trying to sell to governments and policymakers. And surprisingly enough, in fact, most of them have been convinced. As I told you, we work in 15 countries in Latin America. We've got 10 formal agreements with national governments. We are now entering in Africa. We hope to have probably between 20 and 30 formal agreements with additional governments in the coming 3 years in Africa and Asia. So this is probably a good... Well, it proved to be a very good idea, indeed.
Absolutely. It's a huge scale, and the dynamics of winning are very interesting. What about the banks themselves? I mean, banks have been reluctant to work in this sector of the market, often fixed costs. It's not easy to access money in some places, and there are all kinds of charges which could quite easily eat into poor person's savings and things. What needs to change there?
Indeed, you're right. Many commercial banks, at least 10 or even 5 years ago, were thinking that low-income families, for not saying poor, are not a good business, because low balances and few opportunities. So for some commercial or very commercially oriented banks, it will not be a business anyway. But there are many, many, many small business banks and even commercial banks now willing to get nearer and nearer to the base of the pyramid. So if you look at Latin America, for instance, I don't know, from out of 10 banks, 8 probably are interested in the base of the pyramid, and this is quite new. They understood that this could be effectively a good business. We do work with them. We work with banks to prove them there is a business case there. We help them develop better deposit-taking services. We help them develop insurance services. We help them, or at least sell insurance services. We help them understand that it's a massive, interesting, and profitable business. It should be, it must be profitable, of course. We want this to be sustainable. We want to work in market conditions, and we believe in markets, so even for the poor. So that's the first element of your question. We not only work with governments to convince them, we also to convince them help improve their financial inclusion and globally inclusive public policies, but we also work with banks for them to understand how they could make a business out of those low-income families. And it implies working on product design. It implies working with the regulator in many countries. In many countries, of course, superintendencies of banks are not necessarily managing the best possible banking rules. So we help those regulators improve their rules. We help them develop the opportunities for banks to have savings account with no administrative costs, low cost savings accounts, but profitable. And that's part of the game. Then when it comes to access, indeed you're right, there are many places in Africa, Asia, Latin America where you have to walk 2 days before meeting a bank, a brick and mortar agency, or it's, well, for different reasons, it's quite difficult to get to get access to those banking services. This is about to change. This is changing already, because for basically two reasons, you've got banking agents more and more in many countries now. And banking agents are everywhere in Latin America, usually in most countries in Latin America. So you don't need anymore a brick and mortar agency to get access to financial services. You've got banking agents. And of course, you've got e-banking. 95%, 96%, 97% of the poor do have mobile phones, and most banks now are developing mobile applications for managing your bank account. So managing payments. I don't need to tell you about M-Pesa in Kenya. Everybody knows about it, but those payments and bank management programs using mobile applications are now everywhere, and it's just the beginning. So the problem of access is not a problem anymore. This is what I believe, at least. I'm convinced that less than 24 months, you could buy a smartphone, not only a mobile phone, but a smartphone for $10 or $15 or $20. That means $5 second hand. That means $2 third hand. That means that most of the poor will have smartphones in the coming 2 years or 3 years. This is not a problem anymore. We also work on e-banking solutions with banks and with regulators and with governments.
Right. That's very interesting. I know somebody I spoke to said there's more mobile phones than people in South Africa. Definitely the next wave of financial inclusion will have that as a key part of it, I'm sure. Just changing gear a little bit, you mentioned really that this isn't the beginning of your social entrepreneurial career, and it's kind of been at the heart of what you've been doing for many decades. So what do you think it takes to succeed as a social entrepreneur? And for people who are listening who are at an early stage in their journey, what kind of qualities or frame of mind and outlook do you think is required to improve your chances of having an impact?
I don't know how to answer that. You need to be convinced, of course, this is trivial, but you need to be convinced that accumulating profit is might be a useful tool, but it's not. It cannot be a goal. I mean, if you believe that profit is useful, if you reinvest it for public goods, then you are a social entrepreneur by definition. So you need to be convinced. You need to have fun, because if not, it doesn't work. And this is the most important, I believe. Never believe people telling you this is impossible. Never. We are working on a project since several years now, and the first phase of this project is already online. It's called littlebigmoney.org. But I cannot explain you at present what we are doing precisely, but I can tell you, because it's not public already, but I can tell you what's the dream behind this new project we are working hard and investing a lot. The dream is the following. I want to create the first ever stock exchange for the poor's businesses. When you say that to any reasonable academic, he or she would tell you, this is impossible. And yes, indeed, it's impossible for many reasons, due diligence processes, costs, etc. They would tell you it's impossible, or they would tell you it's useless, but that's another story. And I believe that if you want to change something globally, you need to develop those crazy ideas. Maybe it won't work. I don't know. But you cannot satisfy yourself by saying, okay, I thought about this, but intelligent people told me it's impossible, so I forget about it and move on. We don't move on. I mean, we are working on this dream since 5 years now. And I'm thinking about this since more than 12 years now. And we believe that we are at the verge of finding a way to do that. And still, there are so many people telling you it's just impossible. So never believe people telling you it's impossible. Never. This might be another characteristic, but not a characteristic of a social entrepreneur, but of maybe of just an entrepreneur.
Yes.
Well, I don't know.
So dreaming big, having big ideas.
Dreaming, but not dreaming, you know, like dreaming with your 2 feet on the ground. I mean, we dream, but we've got big dreams, but we are practical people. I mean, we try to find practical solutions for those dreams to be feasible at some point in time. I mean, it's not about dreaming for dreaming, you know.
But it's a difficult thing, isn't it, for somebody to know, until a particular moment in time, it could seem impossible, and then suddenly it happens, and everybody, you know, retrospectively, it all looks very different. And I guess for a social entrepreneur to have with a big vision, and everybody saying it's not possible, it's hard to know whether or not it is really impossible, or whether they're being unrealistic, or whether if they keep going, that in some manner or form they will see it, their vision realized.
You know, there are so many funny stories about that kind of thing. I mean, you remember? I don't remember his name, but he was an ex CEO of IBM saying, microcomputer will never find a market. It will never exist. And that was 40 years ago. Some people in their garage wanted to do this, and they did it. And they changed the world in a way, in several ways, in fact. But dreaming is not necessarily, you know, when I When I'm telling you that we are dreaming big and with our heads in the stars, but our feet on the ground, it's not necessarily about big dreams like the one I told you, first stock exchange for the poor. It might be smaller things. I don't know how old you are, Fergal, but I'm old enough to remember that when I was a young consultant and I had to travel, I had to carry my luggage, my suitcase, because nobody thought before that it was possible to put wheels under the suitcase. And this is a recent invention or innovation. I mean, wheels exist and suitcases exist since so many years, and nobody thought before that it was interesting to put wheels under suitcases. And it changed definitely the way to travel, didn't it?
Absolutely.
And this is also innovation. Innovation is not necessarily inventing from scratch everything. It's sometimes recombining, rearticulating existing mechanisms and things in order for them to work better and drastically better. Maybe one more thing. Never believe people telling you it's impossible. Well, this is, again, it might be trivial, but try to, whatever you think different. Try to think different from what you think. I mean, I believe this is like this. I believe something is like this. Why if it be different? Why if I would change it completely? Why if you remember, you know, the, how it's called, the Fosbury flop. Do you know about the Fosbury flop?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in 1968, as far as I remember, this young athlete, Dick Fosbury, at the Mexico Olympics, decided that it was a better way to jumping back to the bar. And he thought absolutely the contrary of what everybody was thinking at that time. And invented the Fosbury flop, and everybody now is jumping using the Fosbury flop technology, methodology, method. So it changed different. He thinks different. All of a sudden.
Yes, absolutely. And when somebody broke the 4 minute mile, again and again, when people do something, see an obstacle or a boundary, then it suddenly realized that it was maybe an obstacle or a boundary in the mind, in our
absolutely.
Mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, absolutely. And prejudices. I mean, many, many, many people still believe, for instance, the poor do not save. That's crazy. There are hundreds of academic studies. There are thousands of empirical evidences, but they still believe the poor do not save. That's hard to believe, but it's like that.
Well, clearly the work that you're doing will have a big impact on hopefully changing that particular viewpoint. I'd like to wish you the very best with Fundación Capital, and thank you very much.
May I add something?
Thank you for your time.
Whatever we do, we cannot do it or succeed alone. Never. We need partners. We need to network with others. And maybe this might be a message for whoever is willing to listen to us later on, but we always need partners. Whatever you do, you cannot succeed alone. Never. We need partners. We need to learn from partners.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast.
This is absolutely
I hope you found this interview inspiring.
Absolutely.
Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com
and
subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.